All right, good afternoon, everybody. It is 3 o'clock Thursday, April 22nd. We are doing Chem 12BL, and I'm going back to lab. I'm going back to our roots today. So we've been using a lot of lab time and stealing a lot of lab time in order to be able to do lecture. And I'm done with it. I'm tired of it. We need to do some more lab stuff. And so while I haven't still gotten the recordings up and running, but my back's getting stronger, and I'm thinking this weekend I'm going to really give it a good effort, see if I can get that done. I'm going to have us do a little bit of something else related to lab today. I'm going to talk about the last experiment that we would normally do before we open it up for special projects. And this is a really cool experiment. And the reason that I enjoy it and do it last before special projects is because it gives you a taste of what special projects is. It gets you ready for unknowns in that sometimes not everything works and you need to figure out why it's not working. And you need to figure out how to make it work. And it also gets you ready for designing your own reactions. It helps with understanding how do we scale a reaction? How do we scale things down or scale things up? And what is involved in scaling a chemical reaction? How do I select the right glassware for the size reaction that I'm doing? All of those questions. And it also introduces chemistry that comes after we get through some of these aromatic reactions. It introduces enolates and enolate chemistry and some chemical concepts that we're going to see later in lecture. And so it gives you an introduction into that, which is also really nice. So there's a lot of really good things about this. Okay, so let me go ahead and start a screen share and we'll get into it. And we'll see how far we get into it today. I really am interested in only about doing an hour and a half. I'd like to try to end close to 4:30 as opposed to going to 5, if we can. That's sort of my goal. Okay. Oops, no, I want to be in that app, but I want to be in OChem Lab Notes. So this experiment that we're going to look at is experiment 64, and it's called the Michael-Aldall reaction. Or we call it, we refer to it as the Michael-Aldall experiment. And it's experiment 64 in Pavia, fifth edition. And in that fifth edition, it starts on page 564. Other textbooks, other versions of Pavia, it comes earlier in the book a little bit, but you can always look up Michael-Aldall experiment and find it. Okay, and it relates back to an earlier experiment in Pavia, which is experiment 37 and 38. Yeah, 37 and 38. Okay, so here's the gist of the way this works. In experiment 37 and 38, what they have you do is they have you take acetophenone and react it with an aldehyde that it has a group on it. It looks like this. They have you react that in ethanol, 95% ethanol with sodium hydroxide. And it makes a molecule that is called a chalcone. We'll look at the reaction mechanism. I'll show you the way this works. But I just want to show you basically what it is. That they want you to do. That's the chalcone. And then in a second subsequent reaction, they have you take the chalcone
and react that with ethyl acetoacetate. And they do this also in ethanol with sodium hydroxide. And this reaction does the Michael Aldall reaction, where it's actually, when you combine a Michael and an Aldall, and all of this we'll get into, they call it a Robinson annulation. So this is technically a Robinson annulation reaction that winds up occurring here. And it makes this really big six-membered ring system. That is not pretty. Come on, you can draw better than that. And then this has that group off it, and this has this group off it. Okay. And so this is number 37. This is number 38. Those are the reactions that they have you doing. This is aromatic. And then in experiment 64, what they do is they give you an aldehyde to start with. That has an R group on it. And the R group can be any one of four different things. It can be a chlorine. It can be a methoxy. It can be a nitro. Oops, that's supposed to be NO2. Or it can be just a plain methyl, as opposed to the groups that they gave you here in this one. So what we're looking at is we're looking at how this group is affected by the change for these other substituents. And they ask you to repeat the experiment and in asking you to repeat the two experiments, they want you to make a target of 1 millimole of this material. And that's all the instructions they give you, is they say, make 1 millimole of this. And look back at experiment 37 and 36. Well, not quite. They give you a little bit more of instruction than that. But that's our goal. Our goal in experiment 64 is to make 1 millimole of this and to follow essentially these instructions. But you have to scale it to get 1 millimole of this approximately. It doesn't have to be perfect. You're not trying to get exactly 1 millimole. It's just sort of your guidelines for how to set up these reactions. And you will be assigned one of these four derivatives. And based on the derivative that you're assigned, I want you to go back and scale the entire reaction, figure out what size glass you're supposed to use, come back and approve the plan. And then when the plan is approved and I turn you loose, you go and you synthesize first off your calcone with this group in it. And then after synthesizing the calcone, then you take the calcone and synthesize the Michael Aldall product, this guy here. And the issue is some of these groups are activating groups. Some of these groups are deactivating groups and they change the chemical reactivity. Some of them will slow it down, some of them will speed it up, such that when you go to run your reaction, oftentimes different things happen than what you expect. Sometimes the reaction fails. Sometimes the reaction doesn't solidify the way that it was supposed to. Sometimes it goes too solid and it chars and it turns into goo. All kinds of things wind up happening because you're not working with the exact same materials that they gave you in experiment 37 and 38. It is your job then as the chemist to figure out what happened, what went wrong, and how to fix it, what to adjust to try to make the reaction run better and to ultimately make the molecule in question. That is experiment 64. And so there's a lot of unknown there and a lot of things to unpack. So as we're starting to unpack this, first, in order to understand what an activating group or deactivating group does, we need to understand the chemistry. So we need to look at the reaction mechanisms that are underlying these two reactions. And we need to understand the reaction mechanisms a little bit better. And then once we understand that, then we need to look at experiment 37 and 38, and we need to understand the scale and size of the chemical reactions that are done there. And then we need to be assigned a derivative, which we'll do in this period. And then we will work through the scaling. And I will, as a demonstration, help you to scale experiment 37. For next week, I'm going to ask you to go ahead and scale experiment 38 and figure out how to scale that one. So that's our goal. So now let's go ahead and start and look at the mechanism that's underlying these two reactions and how this mechanism works. Okay, so a whole bunch of new chemistry coming your way in terms of these reactions. Okay, let's look at the aldol mechanism. In the aldol mechanism, there are many different styles of aldol. And the different styles have their different names. Primarily, what an aldol reaction is the reaction between an aldehyde and a ketone that produces an aldehyde and an alcohol for the aldol reaction. And then there's something called an aldol condensation. So the reaction starts off, and we'll use benzaldehyde as one reagent, and we'll use acetophenone as the other. These reactions are done in ethanol and sodium hydroxide. And when a reaction involves base, then the first thing that you want to do is look for an acidic proton. And usually it's the most acidic proton. That's what we're looking for. So on these two molecules, we need to sort of consider where the acidic protons are. And fortunately, we don't have to consider too many. There's only really three protons to consider. There are the aromatic protons. And we can consider all of the aromatics to be essentially the same. So there's the aromatic protons. There is the aldehyde proton. And then there are also the three protons, quickly ran out of colors there, the three protons that are on the methyl group, on the acetophenone. And we can sort of assess the acidity of each one of these and figure out which one of these is the most acidic. And because I'm using this to launch us forward in chemistry, and we've been doing spectroscopy, I also sort of want to roll us back and bring a bunch of language into this that we've used throughout the year, but may have gotten a little bit rusty, and some concepts that may have gotten a little bit rusty. Okay, first, let's consider each one of these anions and think about which one of these anions might be the most stable anion. And the reason we're looking for the most stable is because the most stable anion tells you about the most acidic proton. Remember that acidity and basicity run opposite each other. So the most stable anion is going to be the weakest base, and its conjugate will thereby be the strongest acid. So by finding the most stable anion, we also find the most acidic proton, if that makes sense. So we've got to understand then the contributing factors in the stability of each one of these anions. Well, how do we assess these? Okay, the first one looks like there could be resonance within the first one. However, I would caution you in that if we take a look at the structure of this, I keep trying to draw it, there we go. If we take a look at the structure of this anion, and let's put the anion here, there's the lone pair.
Are you drawing?
And, oh, it's frozen.
Yes.
I see it on my screen that it stopped and froze. Sometimes it just gets buggy. Okay, better. All right, so I'm trying to draw it flat. So here's our molecule, and I'm going to put the aldehyde back out on this side over here. All right, now each of these guys, these are the orbitals that make up the pi bonds, right? And so we know where those guys are. We know kind of what that looks like, that we've got the pi system. And we can maybe include in these that these are the pi system. So there's our pi system. And then I'm curious as to what the configuration of these electrons are. These electrons reside in an sp2 hybrid. And that sp2 hybrid extends out in a fashion that is 90 degrees to the pi system. And because it's 90 degrees to the pi system, there is no way to push those electrons into the pi system and do resonance. So there's no resonance with this anion. This anion just is locked exactly where it is, and there is no resonance allowed. We've never really had to think about that before. Anytime we had a lone pair and we just drew the lone pair, we were always allowed to do resonance. And so why can't I just push this into this bond and push this guy out and do resonance? And the answer is because the orbitals don't align. And when we've done resonance in the past, it has always been with sp3 hybridized orbitals and an sp3 hybridized carbon, which allowed me to have rotation about my sigma bond. And the rotation about the sigma bond allowed this to come into an orientation where it could go into resonance. Not so much with this guy. This guy is sort of very similar to some of the lone pairs and anions that I looked at when I was looking at my aromatic rings and aromaticity. And we know that an orbital which sticks out perpendicular to my pi system does not participate in the pi system and thereby cannot participate in resonance. So there's no resonance associated with this lone pair of electrons. This guy does have a sigma bond, and this sigma bond does allow for rotation about the sigma bond. And I can indeed get resonance, even though the shape of that orbital may not look like it would allow for it. It is possible to get the shape of this orbital in line with the pi system and allow for resonance, in which case I can draw a bunch of resonance contributors for this structure. However, those resonance contributors go through what's called an allelic system. And the allelic system causes, not really the Alenic system itself doesn't cause this, but the resonance causes a disruption of aromaticity. So this is no longer aromatic. And while I can continue to push these electrons around the ring system, and there are additional resonance contributors that I can draw, none of them are aromatic. So there are a total of four resonance contributors, but none of which, this is the most stable. But the others are all non-aromatic. Okay, and then of course with the last one, I have only a single resonance contributor. And that is it. Okay, so A, B, and C. Which one is the most stable? A, B, or C? Pokey, that question mark needs an exclamation mark behind it. I need to know. It's not a question. There we go. All right. But now I'm going to ask you why, Pokey? Why are you choosing C as opposed to A and B? Or maybe I should just say, why C over B? Because A doesn't have any resonance. So if A has no resonance, why would C be more stable than B? Most aromatic resonance contributors, yes. Most aromatic resonance contributors, but there's one other reason, and I'll do it this way. I'll say this is major, and this is minor. Where's the negative charge?
It's on a more electronegative element.
Excellent, JC. Yes, it's on the oxygen. It's on the most electronegative element. And so that is true. And so this is the most stable. It preserves aromaticity, and negative is on oxygen, which is the most electronegative element. And so preserving aromaticity and also putting that negative on oxygen, the negative on oxygen alone is worth three or four resonance contributors where the negative is on carbon. And with the broken aromaticity, it just can't even compare. So C is way more stable. Okay, now that we understand the most acidic proton, now we can actually get to the mechanism. So what I'm going to do, so I'm going to start the mechanism here. And we will start off by taking and drawing the reaction as we would if it were an organic reaction, where we take the electrophile and put the electrophile above the arrow, the nucleophile to the left-hand side, the thing that's going to be reacting with it. The base then is going to start off, and we're going to pull this proton. So we snag the proton, electrons push in, we go to the major resonance contributor. The major resonance contributor in this is related to another molecule that we studied. This is an enolate. Just for reference, this is the enol. This is the enolate, ATE, meaning anion. So enols and enolates are related. And we know that enols tautomerize to their ketone form as their preferred form, that this is a minor structural conjugate. Tautomer. tautomerization. This is the tautomer, and this is the minor tautomer. That's the word that I was trying to get. Enolates are very much the same. This one is the major resonance contributor for the enolate, but enolates like to react through their carbanion. And there is a large partial minus that resides on the carbon. The aldehyde, which I'll do in blue, the aldehyde is the electrophile with a large partial positive that resides at the carbonyl base. The reactivity between the two is this bond targets the partial positive, breaking this bond and moving the electrons up onto the oxygen. And we make a new carbon-carbon bond between the enolate and the aldehyde. Now, notice something else really interesting here. I didn't use an organometallic. And I did it in a protic solvent. And there's a proton that is still here that I'm going to track that proton for a minute because we're not quite done yet. There's a couple more steps here that need to happen. So the next step is we used hydroxide to pull that proton. That means we made water. I'm going to invoke sort of a general base where this could be water, or it could be a methanol. And any one of these things could be contributing that proton. And I'm going to take that proton back, regenerating my base so that my base is catalytic. This leads us to the first product, but not the final product. This product is called the aldol product. Aldol products generally occur when the reaction is done under low temperature. If the temperature is increased or there is a large amount of conjugation that can occur in the molecule, the aldol product will typically dehydrate and go to what's called an aldol condensation product. And this one, because of the high conjugation that can be created, immediately dehydrates. And so the mechanism doesn't stop here. The mechanism continues. And what happens is we pull another proton. And B minus pulls the proton, generates the enolate again. This is the first step in the dehydration. And then from this step, this is where the elimination occurs. Electrons push in, push over, and push out. And the hydroxyl group turns into a leaving group. Now, everybody starts screaming at this point and says, wait, hydroxyl groups are terrible leaving groups. You've always told me never have a hydroxyl group as a leaving group. And generally, that's true. But hydroxyl groups can be leaving groups when you're in a strongly basic condition, as we are here with the sodium hydroxide. So under strongly basic conditions, a hydroxide can be a leaving group because the strongly basic conditions support base in solution. The conditions are right to allow the solvation of a hydroxide ion. And if the hydroxide ion is solvated appropriately, then it's stable. And that's all a good leaving group needs to be. A good leaving group needs to be a stable species in solution. And so under strongly basic conditions, it's possible to have a hydroxide as a leaving group. I know I've never told you that before, but I'm telling you now. Better late than never. And so this group leaves, leaving behind the double bond, which is kind of blue. The hydrogen remains behind. So it's still there, but we're going to ignore it because we don't really need it. And this molecule is called the aldol condensation product. So condensation means water, and the aldol condensation means the bringing together of two molecules with a loss of water. And so that's where we have lost both this proton and that hydroxyl, and those two add up to a loss of water. So there's my water molecule that has come off. Now, these two products also have other names associated with them that you should be aware of. This one, the aldol product, this one is called an alpha beta. Those are the way that we refer to those two carbons. Alpha from the ketone. This is the alpha carbon from the ketone. This is the beta carbon from the ketone. This is called a beta hydroxy ketone. And this is the aldol product. This one, where that guy goes away, and I get the double bond there, these are still the alpha and beta carbons, but this one is referred to as an alpha, comma, beta, unsaturated ketone. And this one is the aldol condensation product. Okay, so this is the main project or main product that we wind up getting out of this chemical reaction. And it's because every atom in this whole molecule is sp2 hybridized, and they're all fully conjugated. And so it makes for a fully conjugated system and a highly stable system. And so this is the main product that this reaction goes to. And the skeleton of this is also referred to when it has both aromatic ring systems on it, the whole molecule, the whole thing, is referred to as a chalcone. So the alpha beta unsaturated ketone is this guy. That's alpha and beta. But when you put the aromatic ring systems on it, both left and right, then we also give it this name. It's a chalcone system. And chalcones are a family of molecules where you can have different substituents on the aromatic rings, and they're all named chalcones. They're all families of chalcones. And in the second chemical reaction, we are asked to take the chalcone and do a Michael Aldol reaction with the chalcone and a molecule called ethyl acetoacetate. So this was the reaction that was 37. I want to go back and look at this. So we just went through the mechanism of 37 and how it makes this chalcone. You can see how I use the word there. Now we're going to look at taking the chalcone and reacting it with ethyl acetoacetate to do this reaction. This reaction They call it in the book in Pavia as a Michael Aldall reaction. It's more typically called a Robinson annulation. I'm throwing all kinds of terms around now. Michael Aldall's, Robinson annulations, Claisen's, Diekmann's, all of these names all refer to very, very similar chemistry, all reacting through enolates and using enolates as nucleophiles. And they name them all differently. So, enolate as nucleophile. When we take a base and pull a proton and make the enolate, the enolate has the resonance contributor of a carbanion. This is the major resonance form. This is the major reactive form. And it's a form of carbon nucleophile. It's a major area of chemistry of forming carbon nucleophiles. And if you go back and you look at all the different carbon nucleophiles that we've learned about so far, the carbon nucleophiles sort of fall into some major categories. We have the alkynyl. We had the Grignard. And we had alkyl lithium, where I can't really draw that bond there. That bond's not really fair. And the issue with these, all of these, is that we couldn't use them in a protic solvent. These guys are too basic, and they react with protic hydrogens immediately to quench. And so you can't use them with any sort of protic solvent. But we know that within our bodies and within biological systems, that every biological system that we know of is in an aqueous solution, is mostly water. Every cell is mostly water. And yet, within these biological systems, they make carbon-carbon bonds all the time. In fact, that is the bread and butter of life, is making carbon-carbon bonds and making new organic structures, carbon-based structures. So how is it if alkynyl anions and Grignards and alkyl lithiums, if they can't be used in protic solvents and they can't be used in water, how does life make new carbon-carbon bonds? It's all through enolates. Enolates, interestingly enough, when we look at an enolate, this thing brain freeze there for a minute. Enolates can be generated and used in aqueous solutions, which is really, really cool to think about. And it has to do with the pKas, that when we take a look at different pKas, and you take a look at the pKa on that guy or on the pKa here is in the 26 range. The pKa range here is 60. The pKa to form an enolate, if I'm looking at this proton has a pKa, which is right around the 18 range. You bring it down that low, and all of a sudden, that proton can be pulled by a whole bunch of standard bases that can be used in water, because water, the pKa in water is 15.7, not that far away from 18. And so it has to do with the conjugation, with the resonance, and the acidity of that proton that allows it to be able to function in a protic solvent. Not only that, if we go one step further and we look at this proton flanked between two carbonyls, the pKa on this proton falls down to between 9 and 12, depending upon the structure, which means that that proton is more acidic than water. That's where things really start to get interesting. And so enolates allow us to be able to do these carbon-carbon bonds and carbon-carbon bond making in protic solvents under mild conditions, things that are the chemistry of life. It is the way that most organic biological molecules are put together within our bodies. And so enolate chemistry becomes incredibly important and incredibly fascinating. Okay, now, also because of that, and because of the many different types of enolates, they give them all different names. And so you're going to see aldols, you're going to see diekmans. Diekman is nothing more than an aldol that happens with an ester. You're going to see Claisens. You're going to see Robinson annulations. You're going to see all these different names when we get to this section of chemistry, but they all go through enolates, and they are just slightly different names because somebody decided that they discovered something slightly different and they gave it a new name. Basically, they gave it their name as they discovered it. And so they're all named after people. But they're all very, very similar. Okay, so now that we've kind of gone through that, let's take a look at this next reaction. This next reaction uses our chalcone and uses ethyl acetoacetate to do the reaction with it. They do this in ethanol. They do it with sodium hydroxide. And they use the chalcone made in the last reaction as the electrophile. So similarly to the last reaction, we need to find the most acidic proton. And if you were paying attention, you would see that the most acidic proton is flanked between the two carbonyls, and that our hydroxide is going to pull that one. Now, this one has three resonance contributors, and it does not matter which oxygen you draw it to. I could go left or I could go right, equivalent. They're all part of the same resonance system. We draw that resonance contributor for the enolate. And we draw the chalcone that it's going to attack down below it. And I think that what I ought to do is I think that I ought to style this in a different color. Let's give it the blue color so that we can see where new bonds are made and how this works. Now on the chalcone, there are two different sites to attack. There is a site which is here and a site which is here. Two different electrophilic sites. And I've drawn them in slightly different sizes so that this site is the large partial positive. This site is a smaller partial positive. Where did that partial positive come from that's there? Well, this is going to take some explanation and a bunch of drawings. So I'm going to restart our mechanism in a little bit. I'm going to do a little bit of a side to talk about how do I know where this enolate this partial minus is going to attack. Is it going to attack at this position or at this position? This is, you need some more theory to understand which position it attacks and why. So first off, let's understand these two positions, where they arise from. They arise from this. If I take this molecule and I consider the electron withdrawing nature of the carbonyl, even though it's a neutral molecule, I can draw resonance contributors for this neutral molecule. I can break the bond. And in breaking the bond, I can draw a negative on the oxygen and a full positive on the carbon. I can also take and shift the electrons over onto that carbon. And I can draw the carbocation there. These three resonance contributors show me that the nature of this molecule is such that I get a large partial positive here and a smaller partial positive here because this is my first resonance contributor. This is the major. It's major because it's neutral and there's no separation of charge. This is the second most important because I have a separation of charge, but they're as close as the charges can be. And this is my third and minor, most minor, I should say, because the charges are farther apart. And the farther you separate charges, the least stable or the less stable the structure becomes. And following that, I could say that the partial positive is strongest on the more important contributor and smaller on the less important contributor. And thus I've drawn them in that size. Okay. Given that, you might assume that the negative charge here would attack the bigger partial positive. Not a bad assumption. In fact, that's a great assumption, but you need more theory. You need something else to understand. So let's take a look at nucleophiles and electrophiles. I'm going to draw out some of the nucleophiles that we've seen to date. So under our nucleophile types, we've seen carbonyls act as electrophiles. Excuse me, that's in the wrong spot. I'm just talking and not making sense. Nucleophiles, different nucleophiles that we've seen. Nucleophiles are easier. So nucleophiles we've seen RO minus. We've seen hydroxide act as a nucleophile. We've seen bromide act as a nucleophile. These are all things that have minuses or partial minuses associated with them. We have seen alkanal anions. We've seen Grignards. We've seen alkyl lithiums. We've even seen sodium borohydride, where it's the H minus, and lithium aluminum hydride, both of those H minuses. And now we've seen enolates. And so all of these are interesting and yet different from the enolate. What is it that the enolate has that none of these others have? I've actually drawn it. It's staring at you. Maybe I'll make it more prominent.
Resonance.
Yeah. It took the brackets, didn't it? The brackets made it a little more obvious. Resonance. Yeah. Okay. So these guys, no resonance. It's not only resonance. There's a little more to it than that. These guys are what are called hard. And this is what is called soft. Hard, how do I define hard? Small, localized, those are two of the best words that really describe hard, small and localized. Soft can be described as large, polarizable, delocalized. And it's the resonance that makes something delocalized, that delocalizes the negative charge. That means that the orbital that the negative charge resides in is a large orbital, a soft orbital, a polarized orbital. Electrophiles can be broken down in the same way. We can look at electrophiles that have a positive charge or a partial positive. These are things like carbocations. These are things like carbonyls with their partial positive. These could be things that have a halogen on them as a leaving group on the partial positive. Other electrophiles could be simply a proton that can accept electron density as an acid. Can be a simple electrophile. These likewise here are hard, and they are differentiated from something that has an alpha beta unsaturated ketone that has two things. It has a hard site and it has a soft site. The soft site being the beta carbon of the alpha beta unsaturated system. Okay, so in organic reaction theory, what we find is that hard nucleophiles like hard electrophiles, and soft nucleophiles like soft electrophiles. It has to do with the orbital size and orbital overlap. That orbital overlap is best achieved when the orbitals are approximately the same size. When orbitals are approximately the same size, there is a lower energy activation that occurs for those two orbitals to overlap and react and make a chemical bond. And so orbital size plays into this. And that's what soft, going for soft, really means, is it means that orbitals of like size are reacting. So when we go back to the question of this chemical reaction up here, and the question of which one of these two carbons will react, because the enolate is a soft here nucleophile, it will preferentially react with the soft electrophile, and the electrons will flow that way. So I've done a lot of work there to explain why it attacks at the position that it does. This is given the name of a Michael reaction and is also oftentimes referred to as 1,4 addition. I'll show you why that is. Nucleophile attacking at the beta position here. As it attacks, the nucleophile adds in, the negative charge goes there. And if I count 1, 2, 3, 4, or I turn that around, either way, doesn't matter which way I really count it, 1, 2, 3, 4. This is called Michael addition, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, or 1, 4 addition because of the way that I'm adding to carbon number one and the negative charge is falling out on carbon number four. Also called conjugate addition. All kinds of names for it. Okay. So that's what's going to happen. And as that happens, I'm going to start that over again so we can follow through on this mechanism. So the mechanism can all be in one place. I got too much going on in other places, too much that I needed to introduce to you. So we'll just start it over here. Lots of drawing. But that's how organic chemists communicate. We communicate through drawing. Base, Bohs proton. Electrons push up onto oxygen. We make the enolate. That enolate is going to attack in the beta position of the alpha beta unsaturated ketone. Electrons push in. Electrons push from the middle of the bond to the carbon. This bond breaks. Electrons push over. This bond breaks. Electrons push up onto the oxygen. So we've got a flow of electrons. We have regenerated the carbonyl. We have a new carbon-carbon bond. And we have an enolate. Now this enolate is unstable and is a base and is going to abstract a proton. But the way in which it abstracts a proton is it takes the proton back from our base. Electrons push in, come down and grab the proton, give electrons back to the base so that it's catalytic, the base is catalytic. There are numerous more steps here coming up. We are at the first product, but not the final product. We've made the new carbon-carbon bond, and this is the end of what is the Michael reaction in the Michael-Aldol. But because this reaction, because these two molecules that have now been joined are in just the right orientation, a further reaction happens and the reaction keeps on going. The base is catalytic, and there are many more acidic protons that can be pulled. And while there are many more acidic protons, each pulling of a proton takes you to an enolate that can be in equilibrium back with its ketone. There's only one enolate that when you pull the proton, the whole reaction mechanism goes forward. And that's the one that I'm about to show you. So yes, there are many other protons that could be pulled, and there are protons which are more acidic, but there aren't any other protons which lead to further chemical reactions, and they are all equilibriums. And each one of these steps can be considered going backwards. And yet there's only one that takes us in a continual forward sort of mode here. So we pull this proton and we make an additional enolate. So there's the bond that we created and the remains of the chalcone system. The electrons push in, and now there's no more alpha beta unsaturated system. Now there is only the partial positive of the carbonyl itself, and that's what winds up being attacked. This bond breaks, and the electrons move up onto the oxygen. This closes up the ring system and initiates the what we call the Robinson annulation. An annual brings up a cycle, a ring. And that's what a Robinson annulation is. It's the making of a ring. And that's what we're doing here. Okay, so similar to the other Aldol reactions that we've seen, this one goes through a couple more steps. It takes back the proton. This would be the end of the Aldol reaction. But like we saw before, this system can become highly conjugated and it dehydrates. And so there's a dehydration step that occurs identical to the dehydration step that we did before. In other words, another proton is going to be pulled. So two more steps. The base is going to pull this proton. Electrons push in, push up, go to the enolate. Now, a lot of people ask, well, why doesn't this just eliminate directly? Why doesn't it just do an E2 and the hydroxide leave as an E2? And the answer is because an E2 could happen, but hydroxides are poor leaving groups. And it is much more likely because the hydroxide is a poor leaving group that when the proton is pulled, it'll initially go to the enolate, and then the enolate will put pressure on the hydroxide, and the hydroxide will leave in a secondary step. That's where that idea comes from. And I think we have good spectroscopic evidence to back that up, because I think we can see this enolate spectroscopically. It's not a transition state, it's a true intermediate. And so we can see that intermediate in solution while this reaction is taking place. And then that enolate pushes in pushes out, kicks out the hydroxyl group as the leaving group, and we come to the final product. There's a lot of steps in that. And this is also why I like to do this reaction now. And that is because there are so many good things that are coming out of looking at this now. You're seeing larger reaction mechanisms. You're getting used to drawing larger reaction mechanisms. You're getting used to enolates and the way enolates work. We're talking about electrophiles and nucleophiles and just bringing back all this vocabulary of reaction theory that we set aside while we were doing spectroscopy. And so this is a good time to kind of revise all that and bring it all back, review it all, bring it all back. And this is the final product. And if you look at this molecule and where these pieces came from, and we expand this out for just a minute, the ethyl acetoacetate, you can see the full structure of the ethyl acetoacetate that is in here. You can see the new bonds that were made. And you can see the structure of the I'll leave it here. This was the acetophenone structure. That was there. This is a new bond that was created in the course of our reaction. And then I'll leave this piece. As being from our benzaldehyde. And so you can see where each piece came in to make this product. And this was ethyl acetoacetate. So you can see each component and where all the carbons went that went into that molecule, which is really kind of cool. So this is a huge molecule that we're making in this regard. And what we need to do Now that we understand sort of where everything goes and what the reaction mechanism and how it all goes together, what we need to do is to go back to this idea. Let me go back to the first pages that I was drawing. In experiment 38, 38 showed me how to do this with a specific derivative. Excuse me, that was 37. And then 38 took my chalcone and ethyl acetoacetate and made this thing. Then in experiment 64, I'm being told to start with a different R group here and to make this with a new R group here and to make 1 millimole of this. That was my whole target that they wanted me to do. So what I need to do now is I need to back calculate. If I want 1 millimole of this, I need to figure out through the two reactions how much I need to start with overall. Then I need to go back to these two reactions and figure out what scale they did these two reactions at. And then I need to scale them up in order to be able to make 1 millimole of material here. And what they tell me, the way that they tell me to do this, is they give me this information. They say, all right, here's what you're going to do. We're going to ask you to take acetophenone This is 64. Take a set of phenone. React it with one of the benzaldehyde derivatives that you will be assigned. We assign them by taking, I take a molecular model set and I take different color spheres and I assign the spheres based on color, where red is oxygen, blue is nitrogen, yellow is chlorine, and I think the black is carbon. And I have everybody reach up into a hat and grab them out of a hat. And by picking the colored sphere, you know which derivative is that you get. And then this reaction, we are told to assume that it will run in about a 50% yield. So we can expect to get about a 50% yield of this chalcone derivative, where that's the R group in the chalcone derivative. And then in the next reaction, so we expect about a 50% yield here. In the next reaction, we take this and react this with ethyl acetoacetate. In ethanol, also with sodium hydroxide, different concentration though, from the first reaction to the second. And we make the Michael Aldall product. This is so funny. This morning I did this reaction and I think I put the R group in the wrong place now that I'm thinking about it. I have to go back and look and see if I did it right or wrong. And they assume that this one runs in about a 50% yield as well. And so you're going to target, and you want to make approximately 1 millimole of this material at end. And so your first job is to figure out how big a reaction I need to run over here. So if this runs in about a 50% yield and I want to get 1 millimole, how much of this do I need to start with? It's a one-to-one reaction. And I'm not asking you on mass. I'm asking you strictly on millimoles, that if I want 1 millimole of this and I can expect about a 50% yield, and it's a one-to-one reaction, I need to start with 2 millimoles of this. All right, now assume that this runs in 50% yield. If this runs in 50% yield, and this is a one-to-one reaction between these guys, how much of this do I need to start with to get 2 millimoles of this one? 4 millimoles, that's exactly right. Okay, so what we're saying is, if I want 1 millimole here, that means this would have to be 2 millimoles. And to get 2 millimoles of that, I'll have to start with 4 millimoles of that, assuming that I'm going to lose 50% each time. And so 4 millimoles will be reduced to 2, 2 will be reduced to 1. And so I need to start everything off with a 4 millimole reaction. Okay. If that's a 4 millimole reaction that I need to start with, then I need to go back and I need to look at experiment 37. And I need to ask in experiment 37, how big was the reaction that they ran in experiment 37? So we'll look back at experiment 37. Oops. And we will see what they did here. So experiment 37, I did not leave myself enough room. I hate that. Experiment 37, as I look back at it, has 0.150 grams of that material It has 0.12 milliliters of that, 0.8 milliliters of ethanol, and 0.10 milliliters of, I think this is like 10 molar. It's either 10 molar or 12 molar, something like that, of sodium hydroxide. Okay, so now, oh, maybe there's some more information I could give you here. This thing has a molecular weight equal to 120.2 grams per mole. And a density which is equal to 1.03 grams per milliliter. And this one has a molecular weight which is equal to 150.1, I think, grams per mole. Okay. So how big was this reaction? How many millimoles? How many millimoles? I can't say, my tongue's dying to stopping to work. How many millimoles was this reaction? How do we figure it out? What do? We panic. All of a sudden, you're back in Chem 3, or you're back in Chem 1A or 1B, and we have to exercise some of those Chem 1A, Chem 1B skills of going through and doing stoichiometry. And we just have to calculate how many millimoles of each thing it is that we've got. And so we're going to take the 0.12 milliliters of, let's just call this the ketone. This guy's our ketone, because I don't want to write out the whole name. And I'm going to convert that using stoichiometry by first converting the milliliters into grams. And it's 1.03 milliliters for every 1 gram of a ketone based on its density. And then for every 120.2 grams, it equals 1 mole. And then if I want to convert it to millimoles, for every 1 mole, it's 1,000 millimoles. And milliliters cancel, grams cancel, moles cancel, and I'm in millimoles. 0.12 divided by 1.03 divided by 120.2 times 1,000. This equals 0.969 millimoles. So this is approximately.
Wait, I'm sorry. I might be confused here, but I thought it was 1.03 grams per 1 milliliter.
You are correct.
Oh, thank God.
And in fact, let's not put this as 1.00. Let's just leave this as 1, because the sig figs are carried in the upper number, and I don't want to confuse it as if the sig figs were carried in the other thing. And that means that I'm probably even closer to 1.0. 0.12. Thank God somebody's paying attention. Times 1.03 divided by 120.2 times 1,000. 1.03. So it does, it literally comes out 1.03 millimoles. All right, and let's check the aldehyde and see what the aldehyde is coming out at. So that one's 0.15 grams, 150 grams, 3 sig figs. They treat the sig figs a little bit loose here. We're just trying to get a ballpark idea. It's 100
50.1 grams for every 1 mole.
And I think I should include the word aldehyde in here. And then for every 1 mole, it's 1,000 millimoles. And you can see that this is 150 divided by 150. This is going to come out very close to 1 millimole too. 150 divided by 150.1 times 1,000. Divided by 150.1 times 1,000. Much better. That's 0.9999. So this is 1 millimole. All right. So what they did is they used a slight excess, very slight excess of the ketone over the aldehyde. But the idea here is that what they did is that this reaction was a 1 millimole reaction. And I want a 4 millimole reaction, which means that I'm going to be multiplying my reaction essentially by 4. So we need to scale up by factor of 4. Which means that we multiply everything by 4. So when we take that chemical reaction that is here, and we look at everything that's going into it, we're going to take and we're going to multiply this by 4. We're going to multiply this by 4. We'll multiply this and this by 4. We'll take all of those volumes, add them up, and see what the total volume is. And I think there's a workup where they also require 2 milliliters that goes in the same round bottom. And we'll also multiply that by 4, everything. And then we take all those volumes and we add them up and we see what we come out with. So we're going to get 0.48 milliliters. The 15 times 4, we do it by mass here. And then we just sort of estimate that into an equivalent in volume. So 4 times 15, 2 times 15 would be 30. 4 times 15 is going to be 60. So roughly about 0.60 milliliters, roughly. 8 times 4, 0.8 is going to be 3.2. Four times 0.1, that's going to be 0.4. And then this workup, which was 2 mils, this is going to be 4 times 2 is going to be 8 milliliters. So our total volume that we're going to have, 0.48 plus 0.6 plus 3.2 plus 0.4 plus 8 equals 12.68. Total volume. So approximately 13 milliliters. Round bottoms, when you pick a round bottoms come in 10 milliliters, 25 milliliters, 50, 100, 250, 500. These are sort of standard sizes. And the golden rule is you never fill a round bottle more than 50%. So at 12.6 milliliters, we would go for a 25 mil round bottom as our correct sort of sizing glassware. And everything that we do for this first reaction is going to be based on the reading of the reaction and all the things they want us to do and a 25 mil round bottom. And now our job is, now that we've sort of scaled it, now our job is to take our actual derivative and to calculate how much mass and volume of each thing and to write out a procedure and the sizes of the glassware that we're going to use that is going to be for that 25 mil round bottom in this reaction that we want to run. And we've gone through and we've sized it all. Okay. So what I would say is I would go with this derivative. Let's do the methoxy. And use experiment 37 as model. Scale 4 times. Write out procedure. Using this guy and its specific molecular weight to calculate out how much of the material you're going to need and to sort of write out your procedure as a 4-time scale up. That's number one thing. Number two, also scale 38 using our work here as a model. So basically what we did is we went through and we took everything out of experiment 37, wrote down each of the things that are going into it, including the workup that goes into the round bottom. We calculated using the amounts of each thing that they gave us. We calculated out how many millimoles that reaction was. And we thought about how many millimoles we needed it to be. We needed it to be 4 millimoles. And so we scaled everything up by a factor of 4. And then we're going to go through and we're going to actually write that all out for that reaction. Then we need to go back to the next part, this part here, where we need 2 millimoles of this. So we need to go to experiment 38 and see how many millimoles that experiment is, writing it out the same way, and scale it to a 2 millimole reaction. And then write that one all out and figure out what size glassware we need to do that reaction in and how to set all that up. And that's what I want you guys to do for Tuesday. So this isn't anything that I'm going to put in Canvas. This isn't anything that you need to turn in. This is just something that I want you to do for practice and working it out. And we'll come back and we'll discuss it more on Tuesday. And then we'll go through some more of the rest of this chemistry on Tuesday and looking at what can go wrong with these reactions, how to anticipate what might go wrong, and talk about how we might fix some of these things. Okay?
I have a quick question.
JC, go.
So for Tuesday, you want us to figure out the whole millimoles and glassware size. Are we also writing out the whole procedure as well for Tuesday, or are we going to look at 37 before we do that?
I think you can write out the procedure because the procedure really is the exact same procedure that's in the book. You're just changing the amounts and changing for this specific derivative here. So this is the methoxy derivative. And the numbers for the molar mass and the other things are in the book for this derivative under experiment 64. So you're just going to work back and forth between these three experiments, 64, 37, and 38. And there's data for this guy. In experiment 64. Looking to see where.
And then also I'm a little confused on how you got the volume for the aldehyde component when we were just given the grams.
Right. Okay. So what I did there is I assumed that even though I was just given grams, that however many grams, I assumed a density of one, essentially, so that when it goes into solution, it was just to give it a ballpark, because its density isn't going to be 2, and its density isn't going to be 0.5. Its density is going to be somewhere near 0.7. And I just rounded it up to a density of 1 and just said that its volume and its mass are probably going to be really similar.
Okay, so we should do that for...
Yes.
Okay, cool.
That just makes it easy, because really what you're doing here is you're trying to get close. You're not trying to get absolute. All you need to do is get close enough to choose the right size glassware. And if we were off by 10% in either direction, it wouldn't affect the glassware calculation. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Cool. Those are awesome questions. Okay, I need to run and go do dinner party and mushroom tarts. But I want to make sure that I got all the questions. So if there's any more questions, I want to make sure I get that too. So don't feel like I'm pressuring you that I need to leave. Go ahead and ask if you have a question. And there may not be. All right. That's the other thing that I told the morning class is I told the morning class too, that this is all new chemistry. There's a lot to absorb here. And that it may not be until the second lecture where we start dealing with this a little bit more, when you get into it a little bit more, that you realize, oh, I didn't have enough information to do what he asked me to do. That's okay. That's why there's nothing to turn in here. I don't want you to feel an enormous amount of pressure on this, but I do want you to try. And we'll come back and we'll talk more about it on Tuesday.
And then really quick and unrelated, what are we looking at for the exam?
Ooh, next week. I'll probably put it up this weekend and it'll go through next week for the exam.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. So I'll give you a week to complete that same format, same thing that we've been doing, and same sort of openness and working together and same sort of time frame. Okay. You're welcome. All right, everybody, I'm going to cut it. I'm going to stop the share, and you guys have a great weekend, and I'll see you on Tuesday.